You're listening to Books and Tunes with Chris Penhall.
You're listening to West Wilts Radio.
Hi, welcome to Books and Tunes. I'm Chris Penhall and I love books. So we'll be chatting to a couple of people who write them in the next hour. Coming up, novelist Ella Cook chats about her new novel, Second Chances at the Little Village Sanctuary, and she'll also be talking about how writing helps her mental health. And later, we hear from Liz Middleton, the author of Three Brave Hearts, the history of three of her relatives, beginning with the First World War. But first, music. And having recently watched the Olympics closing ceremony, the playlist today is artists who have performed at Olympic ceremonies and their celebration concerts. So we begin with the Red Hot Chili Peppers and Can't Stop.
Best friend, peace and love is living. intimidate her. Can't stop the gods from engineering. Feel no need for any interfering. Your image in the dictionary. This life is more than ordinary. Can I get you maybe even three of these? Coming from a space to teach you of the Pleiades. Can't stop the spirits when they need you. This life is more than just a read through.
You're listening to Books and Tunes with Chris Penhall.
Hello, Ella Cook. Thanks for joining me today. You've written three books already and your next one is coming out very soon, isn't it?
It is, yes. It's due out on 3rd of September now, and it's another book in the Brocklington series. So it's really good fun to be going back to the little village and seeing what's happening with everyone.
So let's take you back to your first book. Tell us about that and when you started writing it and how you got it published.
Oh, wow. My very first book, my debut, it's not part of the Brocklington series. It is a standalone novel. And I started writing that when my mum was undergoing chemotherapy. I needed an outlet. I needed something positive to focus on while that was ongoing. And mum was always a massive, massive reader. And she struggled with focus during the chemo, and she got a lot of neuropathy in her hand, so she couldn't always hold the bigger books that she liked. So it became a deal that for every session of chemo she had, I would send her new pages, and she would literally print them out on the dodgy as anything printer at home, half of it blurring and spotting, and take them with her, and she'd read them in the chemo wards. And I was really lucky to have a really flexible job at the time. So a lot of the treatments I would take her up for, because my dad had a job that didn't lend itself to being able to be in hospital very often. So some of her rounds, it was two rounds of treatment every single week. And it was tiring for her. And they used to give her these antihistamine drugs that they give with chemo sometimes to stop her having a bad reaction, and they would knock her out. Literally, where you could see within about 2 minutes of the cannulas being started, she would be dropping off. So yeah, I'd take her up there, we'd sit and we'd gossip, we'd make everyone laugh for the first hour or so. I'd go around the rest of the ward, make everyone drinks. Then I'd whip out my laptop, feet up on the bed, getting told off by the nurses. And I literally sat and wrote the book for mum sitting in the oncology wards with her.
And it's called Beyond Grey, isn't it? And it does touch on grief and
very,
death.
Very much so. I killed the main character about three lines before the first chapter opens. And it's very much the idea around what happens if you did die unexpectedly to your family, and if you weren't able to move on. So the main character, Jen, becomes something of a guardian angel for her family to help them process her grief and be able to go through that first year without her and work out how to move their lives forward.
So when you finished it, how long did it take you then to have the manuscript accepted by a publisher?
I'm embarrassed to say that I had a couple of rejections straight off and thought, nah, I can't do this. And I shoved it away for the longest time. Then I met some wonderful ladies in a local writing group who encouraged me to pick up the proverbial pen again. And they sort of read sections of it. And I read it through myself, did what I realized now was a fairly light touched edit. Sent it off to a few other places, including the original chocolate run by Lynn, and was absolutely shocked and amazed when I had a phone call, an email saying, can we have a chat with you? And yeah, so it was a very peculiar thing, because it was just as they were having some changeovers in the office and they were just moving to home working. So originally the call was supposed to be with one person. That didn't happen. So I literally had a phone call from the owner of the publishing house saying, I want to talk contracts with you. You want to accept this book? She's like, oh, had I not made that clear? And my knees literally gave out and I ended up sitting on the floor trying to gather my thoughts enough to have a professional sounding conversation with someone who was literally holding my dreams in their hand saying, we want to publish you. From starting to write it to actually doing something with it, it's probably a good few years.
But you're on a roll now, because You've written two more that have been published and another one that's coming out very soon. And you've written the first in the Brocklington series that's already come out, and the next one's coming out soon. And another one that is also about people coping with big changes in their lives. And that's Summer's Christmas, isn't it? Tell us about that.
Yeah. Summer's Christmas. I wrote with ju it was just the idea of I'm really soppy. I love Christmas. I love all things sparkly, but it's not just the kind of the glitter and the glamour and the fun of it. It's that feeling that people seem to have, that goodwill to all men, and especially nowadays, that is so missing lately. It seems that our sense of wonder, our sense of love for one another, and our sense of community, especially what we've seen going on around the country with violence and riots and communities pulling themselves apart instead of together, that really upsets me. And I've always really valued that sort of sense of community. And the idea of, is there a way I could bring the magic of Christmas and community into summer has always stuck with me. And then, yeah, the idea of what could bring a community together to do something like that? Yeah, unfortunately, I went the mean route and gave a little girl cancer, but it's okay because it all works out in the end. But yeah, it's very much that sort of, is there a problem big enough that would bring everyone in a village together, everyone in a community together to fight for a cause that could also bring the magic of Christmas into summer? And yeah. What I didn't expect when I started writing it was that it would create this entire community that's ended up being a Brocklington series, because I went from writing this peculiar little standalone novel that the first publisher always described as my Marmite book to being a series writer. And I don't know how that happened, but it's amazing.
So the second Brocklington book, tell us about that.
The second Brocklington book that came out towards the end of last year, and that was called Healing Hearts in the Little Village. And it's set around, it follows the some of the main characters from the original Summer's Christmas book, and it steps into the local GP surgery. And it's about, again, it's sort of that, it is that healing. And we bring a new doctor who, she's had a bit of a bad time. She's had a really rough time working in London, and she's recovering from some injuries she sustained on the job, unfortunately. And she's been talked into mentoring, what am I talking about? She's been talked into locuming for her old mentor and basically covering his surgery while he's off trotting around the world and helping set up healthcare facilities in war-torn countries. And it's very much following her journey of healing. It's a grumpy sunshine book. Liv, Dr. Liv, she is absolute sunshine. She is exactly what you would hope to find in your local doctor. What she didn't expect was for the practice manager to be quite such a grumpy old so-and-so. But it turns out that while his first and second impressions might not be that good, he does pretty well on the third ones.
And the next one is coming out very shortly, isn't it? So tell us more about that.
Oh, this is a book that I've been wanting to write parts of for quite a long time, and I'm really excited that I got the chance to. Again, it's set in the Brocklington village. This time it's at the animal sanctuary. And some families keep cats, some families keep dogs. My family has always kept birds. And I've had a couple of rescue parrots of my own. And at the moment, we've got a very small parrot who's got some special needs. But he's an absolute sweetheart and he's absolutely spoiled and completely rules the household despite weighing only about 2 ounces. But yeah, because of his special needs, I've got enmeshed, and in order to be able to look after him as best we can, I've learned a lot about rescue animals and rescue birds in particular. And I'd always wanted to write a book in which we have a rescue parrot because it's such an unusual concept, but they're such wonderful, intelligent little creatures. So, yes, this book follows on almost immediately from the end of Healing Hearts, which is a little bit of a bang. And a little bit of a cliffhanger, but we meet the person who might have caused the cliffhanger, and he's been advised, let's say, by the courts to go and do some volunteering work in the not voluntary sense of the word. So he ends up being sent to help out at the village animal sanctuary, where he meets our main character, Angela, who is not going to put up with any of his nonsense. And unfortunately for Rick, nonsense is one of the things that he specializes in. He's works there for a little while and he finds out that actually he's really quite good with animals. In particular, we meet a rescue cockatoo who unfortunately is just dumped in box. I wish this was something that never happened, but it is a story that I've heard too frequently in the rescue community. People get these beautiful birds, think they'll be brilliant, think you can just shove them in the cage. Then they turn into destructive birds, they develop problems, they damage their own feathers and themselves, and they end up being dumped at rescues, much like Mallow, our cockatoo's story. And as is very typical for the type of bird, she falls besottedly in love with one person. Amusingly, it's Rick, who has no idea what to do with a half-bald, swearing, obnoxious cockatoo.
That sounds great, actually, and I don't think I've ever heard a plot with a cockatoo in it. And that leads very nicely to the song that you're going to ask for, after which we'll come back and we'll talk about mental health and writing, because it's something that you've talked about a lot, and how it's impacted you and how writing helps you. But the cockatoo inspired song that you've asked for, what is it?
It is Shake Your Tail Feathers, best known from the Blues Brothers musical.
Well, I heard about the fella you've been dancing with all over the neighborhood. So why didn't you ask me, baby? Or didn't you think I could? Well, I know that the boogaloo is out of sight, but the shingling's a thing tonight. But if ever you and me are a baby, I would have shown you how to do it right. 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 Twisting. Shake, 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 shake it, baby. How it go, loopy loop. Shake it out.
Shake Your Tail Feathers from the Blues Brothers, and I'm back with author Ella Cook, whose fourth novel is coming out very shortly. What's it called, actually?
It's called Second Chances at the Little Village Sanctuary.
You also won an award in 2019, didn't you? Right, just as you were about to embark on your writing career. What was that?
I did. It was the Floella Benjamin Award from the SWWJ, which is the Society for Women Writers and Journalists. And it was their fiction award. And it's sort of a one-off thing. And it was a really, really exciting and beautiful thing to have been selected for because I hadn't been a member for very, very long. And the title of the piece was Children Are Our Future. And it struck a chord in me and it turned into something very wonderful,
And so,
which probably led to me being picked up by Chocolate.
well, these things, one thing after another, aren't they? Sometimes we find ourselves achieving our dreams and we're quite surprised how we get there, but we look back and you think, oh, and in your case, you were diagnosed as bipolar when you were in your teens, weren't you? And sort of has the writing helped you to express yourself? The creativity helped you with dealing with the effects of the condition?
Very much so. I mean, you're right. I was diagnosed with bipolar when I was at university. I just about made it into my second year, so I'd just turned not quite 18. And yes, to be diagnosed with bipolar at that young age 20 years ago, it meant that your symptoms were quite classic and quite severe. But yes, I was very, very lucky that I had some very good wraparound support with the university, and my degree was actually a writing-based degree. And the therapeutic support there found out very quickly that while I've struggled to sit and talk to them about things, give me a pen and paper and leave me alone, and it would all pour out. And writing has been a huge part of my recovery and my stabilization, and it will always be a huge part of my mental well-being. It gives me a place, like you said, to express the things that are difficult to talk about, to explore things like death, like bereavement, like knowing you're losing one of the most important people in your life in an area that's a bit safer than real life, if that makes sense. So yeah, a lot of my books do follow some themes that are quite dark, actually. It is things like bereavement, it is things like recovery, it is things like helping someone heal from damage that you have inflicted to them and learning about personal responsibility and things like that. But at the same time, I think it is quite my nature to be optimistic. So I do always tend to write happy endings, so don't worry about that. Even on the dark, even if the books start quite dark, there is always a happy ending coming. And I find that in some ways, bipolar, I find easier to deal with the knowledge that it will always be cyclical. And even at the worst, darkest, dark points in life, there will always be light and there always will be something to lift you up immediately. And having that faith and having that knowledge is something that personally has given me a lot of strength to keep going, because let's not beat around the bush, it is considered a serious mental illness, and a high percentage of people with it do end up needing quite intensive pharmacological and often inpatient treatment. And I have been very, very fortunate to have found things that enable me to, well, live without having needed any of that. The therapeutic and the community-based support I've had has been phenomenal.
When you were first diagnosed, you were very, very young. Was it
Yes.
something then that you found easy to talk about? Because let's be honest, mental health now we talk about a lot more than even 10 years ago. So it has changed, but then you were really young.
Oh, bless you, 10 years ago, nearer 20. But no, you're right. It was an absolutely horrific time of my life. The triggers for it had been the deaths of two grandparents within a fortnight of each other. One of my both of my granddads, actually, my father's dad, my mother's dad, and obviously both of my parents and the entire family were in turmoil. And that seemed to be the trigger switch that sent me from Yeah, something not quite right here to full on meltdown. And that was the first major manic episode. It was not a good time either. There was a soap opera that I will not name that was quite popular in the UK at the time that had a very similar storyline in that a main character in it was recently diagnosed with a very, very similar serious mental illness. But it being a soap opera, the representation of it was maybe, let's say, not as kind or as pragmatic or as optimistic or as realistic as it could be. In actual fact, I think this character ended up committing murder on someone they loved and ended up in jail. So me not knowing at that young age anything about what this condition was and seeing that in all of the papers, on all the TV, in all of the gossip magazines being talked about in classes and at work. That was absolutely terrifying. So, no, when you hear people go, "Oh, did you see it last night?" Da-da-da-da. And you're thinking, "Oh my God, is this my life? Is this what's going to happen?" Was absolutely terrifying. So, I don't make a secret of my diagnosis. I do talk about it very openly. I will write about it openly because I want people to know that what they might see in the media is not necessarily reality and that there are ways you can cope with it. There are ways that you can live with it. I'm not going to say get better because it's not something that will ever go away. It's always something that will be there and will always be a part of my life. But there are ways that, I mean, I still got my degree. I still got a good, I still built a good career. My relationship, wow. I told that guy to run when I got diagnosed and he's still here. So it's worked out quite well. And yeah, now I'm publishing as an author. So you can still achieve your dreams despite diagnoses like this. And I think that being able to talk about that more widely would have helped me so much when I was a teenager. And I know it helps others now. So I'm never going to shut up about the topic, no matter how much some people would like me to.
So, diagnosed when you
Definitely.
were 18, you've had to manage to learn all about that. You've had to make a life for yourself. You're also now a published author. This is no mean feat, actually. And it's given you, hasn't it, a platform, like you said, to explore themes and also talk about what you've achieved in a more public way.
Yeah, very much so. And I've always said, if just one, especially when I was writing the first debut, if just one person picked it up and found a bit of comfort in it, and if it made their day a little bit less horrible, even if it was just for the few minutes they were reading, then I'd achieved everything I'd wanted to. Sorry, I get choked up about that. That was the difference for me. And I was really, really lucky that I had some lovely, lovely people reach out to me. Total strangers just picking me up on so tracking me down on social media from that book to say exactly that. This helped me when I lost this person who meant so much to me. This helped me grieve. And that really, really has touched me and made a difference.
That was Ella Cook. You can follow her on Facebook and she is on X as Ella Cook Writes. A bit more music now, and the playlist is artists who've performed at Olympic ceremonies or celebrations. And this group are from London 2012. It's the Spice Girls and Wannabe.
you wanna be my lover, you gotta get with my friends. Make it last forever. Friendship never ends. If you wanna be my lover, you have got to give. Thinking it's too easy, but that's the way it is.
So here's a story from A to Z. You wanna get with me, you gotta listen carefully. We got M in the place who likes it in your face. You got G like MC who likes it on a easy V. You doesn't come for free, she's a real lady. And as for me,
you're listening to West Wilts Radio.
Membership at Iford. Have you considered the benefits of becoming a member at Iford Manor? It's just £45 for the year, offers free garden entry during summer opening, plus discounts in the cafe, restaurant and for special events too. Get your membership or give one to a friend. Details on ifordmanor.co.uk. That's ifordmanor.co.uk.
You're listening to Books and Tunes with Chris Penhall.
So, as part of my ad hoc feature, What Are You Reading?, I've cornered, or should I say, asked Maureen about what she's reading. So, Maureen, what are you reading?
Lucinda Riley, The Moon Sisters.
Why do you enjoy Lucinda Riley?
Because her characters are really interesting. There's a bit of mystery, there's a lot of love, and I find them intriguing.
What other novelists do you enjoy? Do you have particular novelists that you go to over and over again as well as her?
I like Lucinda Riley and Ellie Griffiths, quite different authors.
Tell me about Ellie Griffiths, what kind of things does she write?
She writes crime, mainly. But I like her characters. She's got a good character description and the stories are always interesting.
Can you remember the books that you loved reading when you first discovered the joy of reading?
I liked, when I was younger, I liked the classics, but I like a lot of different authors and different genres. Mainly crime or romance, which are very different.
Are you a holiday reader, a sporadic reader, or do you always have a book on the go?
I always have a book on the go.
And is that one book on the go, or are you one of those people that can do multiple ones? Because I can't.
No, one book on the go.
One book at a time.
Yes.
And are you planning your next read as you're getting to the end of the other one, or do you stop and think, oh?
No, I stop and think. I'll go into a bookshop and I'll look at the spine of the book. If that attracts me, then I'll look at the cover and read the blurb on the back.
So you love going into a bookshop and feeling the books?
Yes, that's my favourite place to go. I always go in a bookshop wherever I go, if there's one there.
And do you know who you're going to next? Well, if you're in the middle of reading a Lucinda Riley or you're enjoying it, have you got somebody in mind you're going to next? Have you finished all the Lucinda Rileys?
Yes, I've finished all the Moon Sister books.
And now, who have you moved on to? Now you can't read any more Lucinda Rileys, unless you go back and read them again, because we do sometimes. Do you know what you're going to do next?
I'm going to read the last Ellie Griffiths book in the series, of the Ruth Galloway series.
That was author M.M. Juniper chatting about her favourite books. Coming up, Liz Middleton will be talking about her book, Three Brave Hearts. But first, more music from our artists who have performed at Olympic ceremonies or celebrations. Here's one from the 2016 Olympics. Carry Me by Kygo and Julia Michaels.
Like a kid and a teddy bear, like a leaf blowing in the air, could you carry me? Could you carry me? Like a flag after a war, when you're gone and when you're first born, could you carry me? Could you carry me? 'Cause I don't know how we got so far, you and me. Almost like there's a sense between us, us. So I need to know, could you carry me back into your heart again? Could you carry me right into your distant hands? Could you carry me right back where we started from? Could you carry me on and on and on? On and on and on. On and on and on. On and on. Could you carry me back to where we started from? Remember when we would dance all night, parking lots and velvet skies? I was there for you, and you were there for me. Every time we would start a fight, we'd make love till the morning light. I was there for you, and you were there for me. So I don't know how we got so far, you and me. Almost like there's a sense between us. Could you carry me back into your heart again? Could you carry me right into your distant hands? Could you carry me right back where we started from? Could you carry me on and on?
Liz Middleton, you have written an amazing history of members of your family that dates back to the First World War, called Three Brave Hearts, that has involved years and years and years of research. So tell me a little bit about Three Brave Hearts.
Okay, well, the first one, Louis, was my father's uncle, if not my great uncle. As most people who talk about the First World War, he was actually my uncle. And my father never spoke about him. I didn't even know he existed. He was my father's older brother, who'd been a medical student pre-war and joined up with the Gordon Highlanders. And as I say, I didn't know anything about him until one day a letter fell through the letterbox addressed to Louis Middleton, who I'd never heard of. And I said to my mother, who's Louis Middleton? And she said, your uncle. And I said, what uncle? She said, daddy's brother. I said, what brother? And nothing more was said, actually, until my mother's funeral. So in the meantime, I tried to find out about him. And I just knew from this aura of silence around my father, it was impossible to speak to him about it. But I had an auntie who was a sister of both my uncle and my father, who was a bit more forthcoming. She was a retired, feisty nursing sister of the old school. And she was very fond of Louis. And she told me a little bit more about him. She told me that he'd been at the Somme and they suffered the great terror of men at the Somme, which was being buried alive when they were shelled. He managed to extricate himself from that situation, but it must have been very traumatic. Now, apart from Auntie Maisie, nobody told me anything about it. And I went through life. I went to college. I worked as an orthoptist, which was working in eye clinics with people with assumed to be mainly physical eye problems. But I was aware while I was working in clinics that there were patients who had eye symptoms, but you couldn't account for them with ordinary physical eye tests. And a lot of them were children that had been in war zones, like in the Middle East or in at the time, Rwanda, for example. There'd be French-speaking 12-year-olds arriving at the eye clinic. And I'd suddenly think, I can speak French, so I'd ask them where they'd been and they'd tell me. And these children had very peculiar eye symptoms, but nothing, no physical damage. So that whetted my appetite at clinical level. And then along this time in the 90s, I was invited to take part in a multidisciplinary research seminar into psychological aspects of eye disorders, which I jumped at. And it was like manna from heaven for me. And for 2 years, I attended this session with psychiatrists, GPs, opticians, orthoptists like myself, any manner of people involved with the eyes. And it was revelatory. Now, this seminar had been funded by the request of a man called Inman, who'd been unusually both an eye surgeon and a psychoanalyst at the beginning of the 20th century, and had seen, he worked in the South Coast, at Portsmouth, I think it was, and he'd had men sent over from the Western Front who couldn't see, but nobody could find a physical reason for him. So he developed thinking around the notion of what I call shell eye. He created a great body of work looking into how disturbances of the mind can affect vision. Now, unlike many aspects of parts of medicine, like it's generally accepted that stress can cause a bad back or a headache, but this wasn't for some reason taken on board in the eye clinic. So I was a bit of a lone voice. But I persevered and ultimately managed to set up a little clinic for patients who have similar symptoms that needed addressing. Meanwhile, I think my interest had been fueled by books that came out in the late 80s, early 90s, by Pat Barker, like Regeneration and Sebastian Faulks's Birdsong. Wonderful novels about the First World War that a lot of them were very factually accurate. And I continued to try to get more information about Uncle Louis from the hospital he was in. He'd been in a psychiatric hospital, sadly, for 50 years after the First World War. And it was just tragic because he had been apparently what my Auntie Maisie used to call the flower of the flock. You know, he had everything going from beautiful, good-looking young man, medical student, you know, played golf, everything. And the poor man ended up just sort of gardening in this psychiatric hospital. It was one of the more enlightened psychiatric hospitals of the time, but nevertheless, they did carry out, which to me are horrific procedures, like prefrontal lobotomy and ECT. As far as I know, he didn't suffer those, but anyway, that's where he was. And I spent years trying to get in touch with the authorities at this hospital to find out more about him. And till eventually, one day, I went to the hospital, had a museum, and there was an archivist. And I brought her the last letter that Louis ever sent, which was a letter at the Strand Palace Hotel before he sailed for France. And I showed it to her. And she was nearly in tears, and within minutes, she brought me all his notes in front of me, and I read his entire history there, which was pretty unremarkable sort of history. It was just like sort of what temperature he had, and he was a bit pale looking today. There was nothing very incisive, very revelatory. I mean, it didn't look like he'd had psychotherapy, which was, you know, could have happened at the time. The same time, there were two other uncles that were very significant. there was one, my great uncle James, who was my mother's uncle, and he also joined the Gordon Highlanders, as had Louis. And he'd been an agricultural student. I come from farmers and crofters. And he was sent to Acre. And sadly, he wasn't there very long before he was killed. And I discovered through my research, I don't think my family ever knew, that he was probably gassed. He was probably amongst the first people that were gassed. It's all a bit hazy, and they call it the fog of war. But as far as I can make out, it was a good chance that he was. And his name's on the Menin Gate. And I've been to Menin Gate, and it's such a harsh, chokes me up even to talk about it. You know, to see his name on the Menin Gate is such a powerful experience. And indeed, I also went to Beaumont-Hamel, which is where my uncle Louis stood his last stand. It was at the end of the Battle of the Somme, and they called him subalterns, second lieutenants, and he cut the wire at Beaumont-Hamel so they could get through to the German lines, and essentially the British took this German stronghold, which was the first success, if you like it, the Battle of the Somme, and the end of the Battle of the Somme. And it was probably the end of Uncle Louis, because after that, his story is a bit hazy. And a couple of years after that, he ends up at this psychiatric hospital.
Who was the third Braveheart then?
Well, the third one was also called Louis, which is an interesting thing in itself. It's a Franco-Scot. The story in both my family, and my family are not prone to tittle-tattle, they were quite sort of conservative Scots. My auntie was an upright nursing sister, my father an insurance manager. And according to my family, he was the son of Princess Louise. Now, how this came about was the Thompson part of the family came from across the road from Balmoral Castle, and there was a great big family of them. This was the men.
So you're showing me a photograph now, a black and white photograph of some very young, healthy-looking men there.
Yeah, well, they were all contemporaries of well-known, who's well-known, more well-known, John Brown, who worked for Queen Victoria. Well, they were probably at school with John Brown. So they all worked in the Balmoral Estate, which was a local employer. And as well-known, Queen Victoria liked Scotsmen. And she took one of them, my Uncle Willie, this one, down to Kensington Palace. And he became a page to Princess Louise, which was Queen Victoria's artistic, more rebellious daughter. She used to hang out with all the local artists not far from where I live in Notting Hill and Holland Park, Whistler, and I can't remember the names of them all, Frederick Leighton and all these people. And she married the Duke of Argyll. And she went to Canada, and she took my Uncle Louis with her as servant. My Uncle Louis and his wife Marie, who were childless. Now, they came back home to Scotland with a little baby boy. And my auntie Maisie said the dates did not fit. So the story in my family and the French side of the family was always that this Louis Thompson was the son of Princess Louise. And it turned out Princess Louise eventually paid for him to go through medical school at St. Mary's Hospital near here. He became a doctor. For a while, he was a GP in Lewisham. And then for some complicated reasons, he moved to France. And his mother was French and his wife was French. So he became a GP in Burgundy. And during the First World War, to cut a long story short, he volunteered to work with the typhus epidemic in Serbia. Now, Serbia, as you know, is where the First World War started. And there was a terrible pandemic of typhus there. And there was absolutely no cure. And it was just dreadful. And he and his wife went out there and they looked after the sufferers of typhus. And then there was an evacuation from Serbia as the Austrian army approached. And that Uncle Louis and his wife, they made a retreat over the mountains of Montenegro and Albania to the Adriatic coast, and they escaped to Italy and then back to France. And then you had a whole other story in the Second World War, and the Algerian War, which I haven't written about, but he lived a long and very rich and illustrious life.
So in a moment, we're going to talk about how it feels for you to have done all of this research and finally have a book in front of you, because this has taken you a very, very long time to collate and put together. So what is the song you'd like to play?
Well, the song I like to play is Halloween. It's by two of Scotland's great, sung by two of Scotland's great singers, Sheena Wellington and Karen Powell. I know them both. I sing a bit myself, actually, and I have been to their singing workshops to learn from them. And it's from a poem written by an Angus poet, I come from Angus, called Violet Jacobs, who'd lost her son at the Somme. And it was set to music by also somebody local. And I find it profoundly moving.
The tatty loftons nearly through, their bluen whar the barley grew, and after dark round Auga stack, you'll hear the horsemen stan and crack. Lachlan, but a mind on you, a mind who often we hae seen, 10,000 stars keek down atween the naked branches and below, baith firm and bossy hae their show. Alas, we lived so hard. There's bairns wi geysards at their tail, clorin the door where runs so kill, and will you hear the scrapes and skirls, o lassies with their drooped curls, bobbin furry paws in the pale. The bothy fire is loupin het, a new heat horseman's cast is set. Wrecked all the long war by the knees, the old stood that kept your glees. I can't afford to see it yet.
That was Halloween, and I'm back with author Liz Middleton, who has written a book called Three Brave Hearts, which is a history of members of her family going back to the First World War. And Liz, you have been working on this book for a very long time, haven't you?
Probably, I mean, all my adult life, in stops and starts. I mean, various parts of my life have accelerated my involvement in it, and it's sort of come and gone and woven in and out of my life. But probably most solidly in maybe the last 10 years, because since I've been retired, I've had more time and energy to apply to it.
So how does it feel then that this is a very personal book to you, in the sense that it's about people connected to you? It's not a story of the First World War in a pure historical way. It's a story of your family, really. So how does it feel now, after all this research and actually putting it into some order, you've actually got it in a physical book? I can see it behind you. It's in your bookcase. I can see at least one. No, I can see two copies of it. And it's a very evocative cover. How does it feel to have it physically here now?
Well, I think if I tell you an experience I had, it'll probably answer the question better than me trying to say how I feel about having it. I mean, obviously, it's satisfactory to have had it and completed it. But the most satisfying thing is I was asked to do a talk in Ballater and Deeside, which is the area where these men. And the people, this was in May, and the people that came to the meeting knew some of my family, and they also had uncles and grandfathers in the First World War. And I had basically had to wing it for an hour talking about it. And I found that one of the most satisfying experiences of my life. But, you know, and I can't say, people talked recently about what is joy and the science of joy. And there's another word for it, I can't remember, I've seen in the media recently. But it wasn't joy, it's not joy, I feel. It's a sort of something I've done. It's a sense of I've done my best. You know, I've done my best, there's no more I can do. That is my best. I've tried many things in life, many things I've failed, some things I've succeeded in, but I've managed to finish this book. Nobody can take that away from me.
Thank you to Liz Middleton. And thank you for listening to Books and Tunes. And now for our last song in our artists who have performed at Olympic ceremonies and celebrations playlist. On the eve of the 2012 London Olympics, there was a concert in Hyde Park to mark the arrival of the Olympic torch. And among the bands were Rizzle Kicks. Here they are with Mama Do the Hump. See you next time.
Yo, coming in with a sound fresher than cut grass.
On the start,
second that we enter, if you must ask,
rush past, like you've forgotten your mind.
All the drivers all up in their face, like, can I see a bus pass? But nah, we just want a little wine, bruv. Call me what you want, but you should not call it a night, love. And I might just join a mile high club. Only problem being that I couldn't give a flying.
Yeah, let me touch back down.
Slap her on the bum until it
comes back round.
Half the room's like, oi, what's this all about? With the other half jiving.
I love that sound.
What? Yeah,
I love that sound.
Whoa. Yeah,
I love that sound.
So flick your back butts out once on a mad one. Like, yeah, your mama can hum. Sing. And we're gonna burn some calories right here, right now. Ain't over till a fat boy slims, mama. Yeah, your mama can hump.
To West Wilts Radio.